death of our enemies. Now then, count over the men for me, and tell me how many they are, and who they are. Then I will consider carefully whether we too can face them alone, or if we should look for helpers." Telemachus answered, "My father, I have always heard great things of you, both your strength in fight and your wisdom, but this is something too big. I am astounded at the thought. It is utterly impossible that two men could fight such a host, and all strong men. They are not just 10 or 20, but many more. Listen now, and you can count them up. From Dulichion, 52 lads, picked men with 6 servants. From Same, 24 young fellows, 20 lads from Zacynthus, and 12 from Ithaca itself, the best in the island, and they have with them Medon the marshal, and a fine singing man, and a couple of good carvers. If we attack them all together in hall, I am afraid you might bitterly rue your day of vengeance. If you can think of someone to help us to, do think who would be a faithful and willing ally."
Odysseus answered, "Very well. See what you say to this. Do you think Athena will be enough for us, with Father Zeus, or must I think of someone else to help us?"
Telemachus answered, "That's 2 more, certainly, and good ones, although they do live high up in the clouds. They do rule over all men, and the gods, too."
Odysseus answered, "Those 2 more certainly will not be long absent from the fierce battle when we and my supplanters meet and fight it out between us. But now you must go home at dawn and mix with them all as usual. I will come later. The swineherd shall bring me like some wretched old beggar. If they insult me when I get there, you must harden your heart to see it. Even if they drag me out by the legs or throw things at me, just look on and control yourself. But you may ask them not to be fools, if you can speak politely. They will not listen to you, I am sure of that, for the day of their fate is at hand. Another thing I want you to remember carefully. When Athena, in her wisdom, shall reveal to me that the time has come, I will give you a nod. So be on the lookout. Then take away all the weapons and shields which hang about in the hall and pack them into the corner of one of the rooms upstairs. Every one. Don't leave one behind. If any of them ask what has become of the stuff, speak politely and say, 'I have put them away out of the smoke. Even now they are by no means the same as when my father left them. All the smoke from the fire has quite spoiled them. And there is something else you mustn't forget. I have just thought of it. You may take a drop too much and quarrel. You may make a mess of your supper and your wedding together. You know the saying, bare steel in sight draws men to fight.' But you may leave enough for us too, alone. 2 swords and 2 spears and a couple of leather shields, handy if we want them. As for the others, Pallas Athena and Zeus Allwise will keep their minds at rest. Another thing you must be careful to remember, as you are my true son and my own flesh and blood, let not one single soul know that Odysseus has come home. Not even Laertes, not the swineherd, none of the servants, not your mother herself, only you and me. And we will find out the temper of the women and try some of the farmhands. We'll see if someone somewhere fears and respects us. We'll see who cares nothing and only despises you for a boy." His son answered,
"My father, time will show what my spirit is. Indeed, there is no slackness in me. But I must say, I don't think that will be of much use to either of us. You must judge, of course. You will waste a great deal of time in going round the farms and having a try at each man, and all the while those others are in the house battening on our goods like brigands and sparing nothing. I should recommend you to find out which of the women disgrace you and which are innocent. But I don't think I would go round to all the crofts and shanties and explore. Leave that for afterwards, if in sober truth you have a sign from Zeus Almighty."
While these 2 were talking, the ship which had brought Telemachus from Pylos arrived at the town of Ithaca.
When they were safe inside the harbor, they beached the ship. The servants carried out all the gear and took the king's gifts to the house of Clytius. A message was sent to Odysseus' house to inform Penelopea that Telemachus was in the country, but that he had sent on the ship to town to save his mother any alarm. This messenger met the swineherd bound on the same errand to Penelopea. When they reached the master's house, the crier spoke out before all the household, "My lady, your son has just arrived." But the swineherd took her apart and told her everything her son had bidden him tell. As soon as his errand was done, he left the mansion and returned to his swine. But the pretenders were utterly cast down by this blow. They left the hall and passed along the courtyard wall to the gateway, where they held a sitting. Eurymachus spoke first and said, "My friends, Telemachus has succeeded in his great deed of defiance, this journey of his, which we thought would never come off. Let us launch the best ship we can find and collect a crew and send them off at full speed to tell those fellows to come home quickly." Before he had quite finished, Amphinomus turned on his seat and spied a ship already within the harbor, men furling sails and men still holding the oars. He laughed merrily and called out, "There's no need to send a messenger now. Here they are. Some god told them, or they saw the ship sailing past and could not catch her." They all got up and went down to the shore. They helped to beach the ship, and the serving men carried out the gear. Then they all went to the marketplace, where they kept together and let no one else join them, young or old. Antinous now addressed them. "Damn it all," he said. "See how the gods have saved this man from destruction. All day long we had spies posted on the windy heights, relieving each other when the sun set. We never passed a night on land, but kept our ship afloat and cruised about all night, watching for Telemachus to catch him before he could come in. Well, this time a special providence has brought him home. But don't let him escape. We must find some way to kill him here, for I don't think we shall do our business while he is alive. He certainly has brains and intelligence, and the people are not at all in our favor now. Look alive, before he summons the country to a meeting. I'm sure nothing will stop him. He will get on his feet and proclaim to the whole nation that we plotted his murder and couldn't catch him. They won't like to hear of violence. I'm afraid they will be violent themselves and kick us out of the country, and then it's off we go to banishment. Let's be ready, then, and catch him in the country on his way to town. We can keep his goods and chattels and divide them fairly amongst ourselves. But let his mother and her husband have the house. Well, if you don't like that plan, if you prefer to let him live and enjoy his father's wealth, suppose we give up living here on the fat of the land altogether, and let each man do his wooing from his own house with gifts and pleadings. Let her marry the man that offers the most and has the luck." A dead silence followed this speech. At last, Amphinomus spoke. This was a notable man. His father was Prince Nisus Aretiades, and he was the chief of the pretenders from the meadows and wheatlands of Dulichion. His manners pleased Penelopea more than any of the others did, for he was a good-hearted fellow. This man then rose and said, "My friends, I should not be willing to kill Telemachus. It is a dangerous thing to kill one of a princely race. But first, let us inquire the will of God. If the oracles of Zeus Most High consent, I will kill him myself and bid the others join. But if the gods forbid, I bid you have done." They all agreed to what Amphinomus proposed. Then they broke up and returned to the house of Odysseus and dispersed to their usual seats. But Penelopea had her own thoughts on these matters, and she was a wise woman. She resolved to appear before these wild and violent men, for she had learnt in the house about the plot against her son's life. You remember that Medon overheard the plot and told her. So she came down to the hall with her women, a lovely creature, and stood beside the doorpost of the great chamber, holding her shimmering veil before her cheeks. Then she reproached Antinous, whom she called by name. "Antinous, man of violence, conspirator,
and yet they say that of all the men of your age in this country, you have the ripest wisdom and the most eloquent speech. You have proved to be not at all like that. Madman, how dare you scheme to murder Telemachus? Do you not respect those who appeal to the protection of Zeus? Indeed, it is not decent for men to be treacherous to one another. Do you not know how your own father once came here for refuge in fear of his people? Yes, they were terribly enraged against him because he had joined the Taphian pirates to harry the Thesprosians, and they are allies of ours. So the people were ready to destroy him and tear out his heart and to swallow up all his rich possessions. But Odysseus held them back. Odysseus checked them when they were all eagerness. And now you are swallowing up the house of Odysseus and pay no price. You propose to marry the wife of Odysseus. You murder the son of Odysseus and plunge me into the depth of sorrow. I charge you to cease and tell your friends to do the same.
Antinous said nothing, but Eurymachus had the face to answer,
"That is wisely said, Penelopea, and we do not forget whose daughter you are. But take courage, let no such thoughts disturb your mind. That man lives not and never shall be bred or born who shall lay hand on your son Telemachus, while I live and see the light upon this earth. I declare solemnly, and I am a man of my word, the spear shall suddenly drink that man's blood. Our spear, I should say, for I too was dandled many a time on your husband's knees. And the hero who sacked Ilion would pop a bit of meat into my fingers and a drop of wine into my mouth. Therefore I love Telemachus more than any man living, and I tell you there is no need to fear death for him, at our hands at least. What comes from God none can avoid."
He said this to quiet her, but all the while he was himself plotting the murder of that very son. So she retired to her chamber and mourned for the husband whom she loved until Athena shed sweet sleep on her eyelids. In the evening the swineherd returned to Odysseus and his son. They had killed a yearling hog for supper, and they were busy about that. Athena came near and with a tap of her staff made Odysseus an old man again, clad in mucky rags, for she did not wish the swineherd to know him. The man would never keep the secret. Off he would go and blurt it out to Penelopea. As he came up, Telemachus hailed him.
"So, you are back, Eumaeus. What is the talk about town? Have the heroes come home already from their lurking hole? Or are they still on the watch for me on the way home?"
Eumaeus answered, "Nay, I took no trouble to ask about them in town. I meant to give my message and come back here as quick as I could. But a runner caught me up coming from his friends, and he gave the first news to thy mother. Aye, I know somewhat else, too, which I saw with my own eyes. On my way, just as I was over the city by Hermes Hill, I saw a ship coming into harbour. It was full of men, a regular cargo of shields and sharp spears. I thought it would be those men, but I don't know."
Telemachus glanced at his father with a smile, but he did not let the man see. When they had finished their preparations, they had supper, and there was plenty for all. They ate and they drank, and when they had taken enough, they went to bed, and thankful they were for the gift of sleep.
Book 17. How Odysseus Returned to His Own Home.
When the first rosy fingers of light appeared in the morning, young Telemachus lost no time in putting on his boots for the journey to town. Then he took up the good spear that fitted his grip so well, and called out to the swineherd,
"Daddy, I'm off to town. I must show myself to my mother. I'm sure she will never stop weeping and wailing until she sees my own self. Now then, listen to me. Take this poor devil to town, and let him beg for his dinner. Any charitable soul will give him a cup and a crust. I can't carry the whole world on my back when I have troubles enough of my own. The stranger may be as angry as he likes, and much good will it do him. I am a plain man, and say what I mean."
Odysseus answered, "My friend, I have no wish to be kept here. A beggar's business is to beg for a bite, whether in town or country. Any charitable soul will give. I am not of an age to hang about a farm at the beck and call of some jack in office. You go on, and this man will bring me, as you say, as soon as I have warmed myself at the fire and the day gets a bit hotter. These are a terrible lot of rags I have. The early frost may be too much for me, and you say the town is a good way off."
Telemachus passed through the barton and went off at a rattling pace, with his mind full of the coming fight. When at last he reached the great house, he stood his spear by the pillar and went in over the doorstone. Nurse Eurycleia was there, spreading the sheepskins over the chairs, and she was the first to see him. She ran to him straight and cried over him, all the other women of the household crowding round, kissing and fondling his head and shoulders. Then Penelopeia came down herself, looking like Artemis or golden Aphrodite, and threw her arms about her darling son, cried over him too, kissed his head and both his beautiful eyes, and said through her tears, "So you have come back, Telemachus, light of my eyes. I never thought to see you again after you went over the sea to Pylos, secretly, without my consent, to seek news of your father. Now tell me, what did you hear?"
Telemachus answered, "My dear mother, don't let us have any crying, please. Don't harrow my feelings, even if I have escaped death. Take a bath and put on clean linen, and vow a solemn sacrifice to all gods, if Zeus will grant us a day of reckoning. Now I am going down to the market to bring home a guest who came with me from those parts. I sent him ahead with the others, and I told Piraeus to take him to his house and entertain him properly until I should come." That was what he said. But that arrow missed the mark. She knew not what he meant. Then she bathed and put on clean linen and vowed a solemn sacrifice to all gods, if Zeus would grant a day of reckoning. But Telemachus went out spear in hand, and his two dogs went dancing round him. He was full of enchanting grace by power of Athena, and everyone stared at him as he walked along. All the pretenders crowded about him with pleasant speeches, but there was hatred in their secret hearts. He kept clear of the crowd, however, and seeing a group of his father's old friends, Mentor and Antiphus and Halitherses, he went and sat down beside them to answer all their questions. By and by Piraeus came along the street to the market, bringing his guest. Telemachus lost no time in joining him, and Piraeus began,
"I say, Telemachus, be quick and send some of your maids to my house, and let me hand over the gifts you had from Menelaus."
Telemachus said, "Ah, my dear fellow, we don't know yet how things will go. If those headstrong men kill me secretly in the house and divide all my father's goods among them, I prefer you to have the things rather than one of them. But if I can manage to destroy those men, you may bring the goods to me, and I shall be as glad as yourself." Then he took home the unfortunate stranger. And when they got there, rugs were spread over the seats, and he was taken to the bathroom. After the maids had given him a bath and a good rub-down with oil, they gave him a change of clothing and brought him to a seat in the hall. The attendant poured him a hand-wash from a golden jug into a silver basin, and then placed a table beside him. The housewife brought bread and set dishes of food on the table. There was no stinting in that place. Penelopeia sat opposite with her seat against a pillar, spinning her fine thread. They helped themselves to the good things that were set before them, and when they had had enough, Penelopeia said, "My son, I think I will go up to my room and lie down on my bed of sorrow, which has been always drowned in my tears since Odysseus left us for Ilion with the royal princes. And you would not condescend to tell me plainly if you heard anything of your father before all these rough men came in." Telemachus answered, "Well, mother, I will tell you all about it. We went to Pylos and found King Nestor. He treated me handsomely in his great house, as a father would treat his own son who had returned after a long time from foreign parts. Yes, he treated me handsomely, and his noble sons did the same. But he had not a word to tell me of my unhappy father, did not know if he were dead or alive. So he lent me carriage and horses, and sent me to his grace King Menelaus. There I saw that very identical Helen, who was the cause of that dreadful war about Troy by the will of heaven. Menelaus asked me at once what brought me to sunny Lacedaemon, and I told him the whole story. This made him cry out, "Upon my word," says he, "they are a lot of cowards who want to lie in the bed of a strong man. It is like a deer who lays her newborn sucklings to sleep in a lion's den while she ranges hills and dales for her food. Then the lion comes back to his lair and tears them to pieces, both dam and fawns. So Odysseus will come back and tear these men to pieces. Oh, Father Zeus," he went on, "and Athena and Apollo, if he could only be like what he was long ago in Lesbos, when he up and wrestled about with Philomelides and threw him heavily to the delight of the nation. May Odysseus be like that when he meets these violent men. Short shrift would be theirs. They would be sorry they ever wanted to marry. As to your questions, I would not shirk them or try to deceive you, but I will just tell you what the truthful old man of the sea told me. I will not hide or conceal anything. He said he had seen him in an island, very unhappy, in the house of a nymph, Calypso, who is keeping him there by force. He cannot return to his native land, for he has neither men nor galleys to convey him over the broad back of the sea." That is what his grace King Menelaus told me. When that was all done, I came back. The immortals granted me a fair wind and brought me safely home. This tale moved her to the depths of her heart. Then the prophet Theoclymenus broke in.
"Honored lady of Odysseus, Laertides, indeed he does not know the truth. But pay heed to what I say, for I will reveal it to you and hide nothing. O Zeus, bear witness, first of all the gods, and this hospitable table, and the hearth of Odysseus, where I take refuge, that Odysseus is verily now in his native land, resting or walking, and inquiring of all these evil transactions. Indeed he is, and he is planning the doom of these men. That follows from the omen I noticed while I sat on board the ship, as I told Telemachus at the time."
Penelope said, "I pray, sir, that your words may be fulfilled. You would soon know my gratitude, and you should have bounty enough from me to make others envy you."
While these three were talking together, the intruders were amusing themselves, as usual, in the courtyard before the hall, putting the weight or casting javelins at the mark, bold and defiant. At that moment out came Medon, who was their favorite servitor and always attended them in hall, and he called to them,
"Come along, lads, now you've all had a good game. Let us think about dinner. Come along, dinner at noon is none too soon."
They all jumped up and followed. Into the hall they ran and spread the rugs over the seats. They killed the big sheep and fat rams, killed the plump hogs and an ox from the herd, got ready their dinner.
While this was going on, Odysseus and the swineherd were about their journey to town. The swineherd began by saying,
"I see thou'rt eager to go into the city today, as my master said. Though, for my sin, I would rather leave thee here to take care of the pens. But I respect him and fear him, and he would scold me, sure enough. Masters have a rough side to their tongues. Come along, then, let us start. Already the day is pretty well done, and it gets cold towards evening."
Odysseus answered,
"I see, I understand, I have some sense in my head. Let us start. You go in front and show the way. But if you have a good staff, ready cut, let me have it to lean on, for you say it is a rare rough road."
So he threw over his shoulders the musty old ragged bag and let it hang by the cord. Eumaeus gave him a stout stick, then they started and left the place to the dogs and hinds. The swineherd led, and behind him, like a miserable beggar, an old man, huddled in rags and leaning upon a staff, the master returned to his own home. On they marched down the rocky path until, not far from the city, they reached a spring of clear water, which fell into a basin of wrought stone. It was built by three brothers, Ithacus, Neritus, and Polyctor, and the townspeople used to draw their water there. A clump of poplars grew all round their beloved water, and the cool water fell from high up the rock in a cascade. Above it was built an altar for the nymphs, where all wayfarers made their offerings. At this place they were met by a man driving the best goats of the different flocks for the glutton's dinner. His name was Melanthius Adolios, and two hinds were with him. As soon as he saw the two men, he broke into taunts and foul language, which made Odysseus indignant.
"Here's a procession, ragged in the rear and tatters in the van. It's always like to like, as the proverb says. Where did you pick up this dirty pig, you dirty pig man? The beggar, this nuisance, this spoil sport, he'll stand and rub shoulders on many a doorpost, begging for scraps. He's not the sort that goes begging for my lord's guest gifts. Give me the man to look after a steading or sweep out a sty, and carry a load of green stuff for the kids. He might drink buttermilk till he got a good fat thigh, but this man has learnt only how to do mischief. He won't do honest work. He'll only go cringing about the town and begging for something to feed his greedy belly. I'll tell you one thing, and that you'll find true. If he pays a visit to Odysseus' house, he'll find a shower of footstools flying about his ears and barking his ribs. He will be pelted out of the place.
As he spoke, the fool landed him a kick on the hip. But Odysseus stood firm as a rock, and it did not move him an inch. He thought for a moment that he would kill the man with a blow of his staff, or lift him by the waist and dash his head on the ground. Yet he controlled himself and bore it.
But the swineherd rated the man when he heard all this. He held up his hands to heaven and lifted up his voice in prayer.
"Oh, ye nymphs of the fountain, oh, ye daughters of Zeus, if ever Odysseus made burnt offering to you, grant me this grace, that that man may return and providence may bring him home. Then, man, he would tear all the pumps and fripperies off thy back, and that not go flauntingly through the streets while the herdsmen play the devil with the sheep."
Melanthius, the goat-herd, answered,
"Bless us all, how the son of a bitch does talk. What malice is in his mind. I'll bundle him on board ship one fine day and carry him a long way from Ithaca and make good profit out of him. I only wish Apollo would shoot Telemachus with his silver bow. Or the fine gentleman would make an end of him as surely as Odysseus is dead far away and will never come home."
With this, he left them, plodding along, while he made haste to his master's house and joined the company in hall. He sat down opposite to Eurymachus, who favored him particularly. The servants brought him food and the housewife bread, as usual. By this time, Odysseus and the swineherd had reached the place. They stood still, and the music of a harp came to their ears, for Phemius had just begun to sing. Odysseus took the other by the hand and said,
"Eumaeus, surely this is the great house of Odysseus. It is easy to see that this is no common place. Building upon building, courtyard with wall and coping complete, strong double doors, no one could turn up his nose at a place like this. I noticed that there is a large company at table in there, for I can smell the food, and there is the sound of a harp, and by heaven's decree no harp without a dinner."
Eumaeus answered,
"Thou seen that easily enough, for thou art no fool. But now let us decide what to do. Wilt go into the house first and join the company and leave me here? Or sooner stay thee here, and I will go first? Don't be long about it, or someone may see thee outside and drive thee away with stones, so be careful."
Odysseus answered patiently,
"I see, I understand, I have some sense in my head. You go first, and I'll stay here. I am not unacquainted with hard knocks and volleys. My heart is hardy, for I have suffered much on the seas and the battlefield. This will be only something more. But a ravenous belly cannot be hid, damn the thing. It gives a world of trouble to men, makes them fit out fleets of ships,
ships and scour the barren sea to bring misery on their enemies.
As they were talking together, a hound that was lying there lifted his head and pricked up his ears. This was Argos, whom Odysseus himself had bred and trained, but he had not had much good of him before he went away to the war. Formerly the young men used to take him out to hunt wild goats or hares or deer, but there he was, lying neglected, his master gone, on the midden where the mule dung and cow dung was heaped in front of the gates, ready to be carted out to the fields. There lay Argos the hound, covered with vermin. When he knew that it was his old master near him, he wagged his tail and dropped both his ears, but he could not move to approach him. Odysseus saw and secretly wiped a tear from his eye, so that Eumaeus did not notice. Then he said to him,
"Eumaeus, I am surprised to see this hound lying on a dung heap. He looks a fine animal, but of course I don't know if he has speed to match his looks, or if he is just one of those table dogs a man keeps, something for the master to show off."
Eumaeus answered,
"Ah, well, to be sure, his master is dead and far away. If his looks and his powers were now what they were when the master went away and left him, I'd see his big strength and speed. Never a beast could escape him in the deep forest when he was on the track, for he was a prime tracker. But now he has fallen on bad times. His master is perished far from his native land, and the women care not and do not for him. That's like your serfs. When the master's hand is gone, they'll not do an honest day's work. Aye, Zeus always takes away half the good of a man when the day of slavery catches him."
So saying, he entered the well-built mansion and made straight for the riotous pretenders in hall. But Argos passed into the darkness of death, now that he had seen his master once more after 20 years. Telemachus saw the swineherd coming before any of the others, and at once gave a nod to call him. The man looked round and picked up a seat which lay near where the carver used to sit when he was serving out meat to the company. He carried this to the table where Telemachus sat and took his place opposite. The servitor brought him bread and a plate of meat. Close upon him, Odysseus entered his own home, like a miserable beggar, an old man leaning upon a staff and clothed in rags. He sat down on the wooden floor inside the doorway, supporting himself on the doorpost of cypress wood, which some craftsman had pared and polished so well and made straight as a plumb line. Telemachus called to Eumaeus, and taking a whole loaf out of the basket, with as much meat as his hands could hold, he said to him, "Here, take this and give it to the stranger, and bid him go round the tables, and ask a dole of everyone. When want is by, you mustn't be shy." The swineherd went as he was told, and said,
"Telemachus sends this, stranger, and bids thee go round the tables and ask a dole of everyone. He says, when want is by, thou mustna be shy."
Odysseus said,
"Oh, Lord Zeus, grant that Telemachus may be happy in the world, and may he gain all that his heart desires."
Then he received the food in both hands, and laid it down before his feet upon that dirty bag, and ate while the minstrel sang. As he ended his meal, the singer ended his song, and the unwelcome visitors made a great noise through the hall. Athena stood near Odysseus, and whispered that he should go round and beg bread of the company, to learn who were decent men and who were lawless, but she was not to save any of them in that way. So he went round the company right ways and held out his hand in all directions, as if he were really an old beggar. They were sorry for him and gave. They were surprised also, and asked each other who the man could be and where he came from. Then Melanthius, the goatherd, up and spoke, and says he,
"Gentlemen who are courting our illustrious lady, I can tell you about this stranger. I have seen him before. The swineherd was bringing him along, but I don't know exactly what part of the world he comes from."
At this Antinous began to rate the swineherd.
Ah, you notorious swineherd, what made you bring this fellow to town? Haven't we vagrants enough and beggars enough, confound them? A perfect nuisance at dinner time. Aren't you content that they come here in crowds and eat your master's substance, but you must invite another besides?
Eumaeus the swineherd said,
Maybe that one of the gentry, sir, but that's not the reet of it. Whoever goes himself and invites a stranger from abroad, unless it be one who serves the public, such as a prophet or a physician or a clever craftsman, or it may be a heavenly singer to give pleasure at a feast. Men like these are invited all the world over, but no one would invite a beggar to burden himself with. But thou'rt always the most harsh of all the company to my master's servants, and especially to me. But I don't care, so long as my gracious mistress lives in the place, and my noble young master Telemachus.
Telemachus said to him, Be quiet, don't talk so much. That's his way, to provoke us always with hard words, and he makes the others do the same. Then he told Antinous what he thought of him. How kind you are to me, Antinous. You might be a father teaching his son, when you tell me to chase the stranger out of the house and let might be right. God forbid, give him something. I don't grudge it. I tell you to give. In this matter, pay no attention to my mother or any of the servants about the house. But that is not your way. You like eating better than giving.
Antinous answered, What a lofty oration! What an exhibition of temper! If all the rest of us would give as much as I do, this house would see no more of him for 3 months to come.
His feet were resting on a stool under the table, and as he spoke he stooped and pushed it up so as to show it over the top. But the others all gave something. The beggar filled his bag with bread and meat, and it seemed likely he would have his taste of all the men scot-free before he went out. But when he came round to Antinous, he said to him,
Give, my friend. You seem to me no common man, but the highest in the nation, for you look like a prince. Then you ought to give even more than others, and I will sing your praises over the wide world. I once had estates myself in the world. I lived happy in a rich house, and often gave to a homeless man, whoever he was and whatever he needed. I had serfs in thousands, and everything else by which men live well and get the name of riches. But Cronion ruined me. Such was his will, no doubt. He tempted me to lead a raid of pirates upon Egypt, all that long way, that I might come to destruction. I moored my ships in the river Aegyptus, and directed the men to stay by the ships on guard, while I sent scouts to different places of view. But the scouting parties ran wild and let themselves go, scouring the countryside, destroying the fine crops, carrying off women and children, killing the men. Soon the news came to the city. At dawn they all sallied out, and soon the whole plain was covered with men and horses and the glittering of arms. Then Zeus Thunderer sent a panic among my men, and no one would stand to strike a blow. Death and destruction was all around. There the enemy killed many of us with cold steel, and others they took alive to be their slaves. But they gave me to some friend who met them. He was Demeter Iasides, the king of Cyprus, and he carried me to Cyprus. From Cyprus I am now come to this place, one trouble after another.
Antinous said, What bad luck has brought this nuisance to spoil our dinner? Just stand clear, will you, and get away from my table, or you may wish you were back again in Egypt or Cyprus. What a bold-faced, shameless beggar it is. You stand by each man, one after the other, and they don't care what they give. There's no need to be stingy. Why should they have mercy on other men's goods when there's plenty here?
Odysseus said,
Upon my word, your heart's not like your looks. You wouldn't give a grain of salt to your own housekeeper out of the pantry if you sit by another man's table and can't let yourself stretch out a hand and give me a bit of bread. There's plenty here.
Then he moved away. This put Antinous in a fit of rage. He frowned and said straight out,
You shan't leave this hall with a sound skin after that piece of rudeness.
Then, picking up the footstool, he threw it and hit him full on the back under the right shoulder.
But Odysseus stood firm as a rock,
The blow did not move him. He only threw back his head silently and brooded over his vengeance. Once more he took his seat by the threshold and lay down the bag full of dolls. Then he called out to the company,
"Hear me, you gentlemen who pay court to the illustrious lady, and let me say what is upon my mind. There is really no resentment or bitterness in a man's mind when he is struck in defending his own goods or cattle or sheep. But Antinous has hit me in a base cause, the belly, damn it, which brings many troubles upon mankind. Now, if there are gods and avengers for beggarmen, may Antinous come to burying before he comes to marrying."
Antinous answered, very little like his father's sweet reasonableness,
"Sit quiet and eat, stranger, or go somewhere else. If you go on talking like that, the young men will drag you out by a leg or an arm and strip the skin off your body."
This was too much for the others, rough and rude as they were. They resented it strongly, and one or another would say, "You ought not to have hit the poor vagrant, Antinous.
Curse it all, man, suppose there really is a god in heaven. Sometimes gods make themselves like strangers from foreign lands, all sorts and conditions of men, and visit the cities of mankind to watch their doings and to see whether they are good or evil."
Antinous took no notice, but Telemachus nursed bitter resentment in his heart for that blow. Yet he did not shed a tear, only shook his head silently and brooded over his vengeance. When Penelopeia heard of the blow in hall, she said to her women, "So may Archer Apollo strike him." And the housewife Eurynome added, "Oh, that our prayers might be fulfilled, then not one of them would see morning dawn." And Penelopeia said to her, "Nurse, they are all hateful and full of evil thoughts, but Antinous is most like black death. A poor stranger comes begging bread of those men. It is not his fault. He is destitute. All the others give him something, but this man throws the footstool at him and hits him." So she talked with her maids in her own room, while Odysseus was having his meal. By and by she sent for the swineherd and said to him, "Go, my good Eumaeus, run and tell the stranger to come here. I want to bid him welcome, and to ask if he ever heard or saw anything of my husband. He seems like a great traveller."
Eumaeus answered, "Oh, my lady, if they would not make all that noise down there, what stories he do tell! He would bewitch the heart in thee. 3 nights on end I had him. 3 days I kept him in my hut, for I was the first he come to after escaping from that ship, and I hain't yet come to the end of his tale of tribulation. It's like one of those singers who learn their lovely songs from heaven. He sings, and they all stare at him and listen hard and never want him to stop. He bewitched me just like that in my lodging. Says he is a friend of the master's family, and lives in Crete, where the house of Minos rules. So he started from Crete, and got as far as this after great hardships, rolling on and on and on. Sticks to it that he had heard of the master close by in Thesprotia, and alive, too. The master has a cargo of treasures to bring home."
Penelopeia said at once, "Go and fetch him. I want him to tell me face to face. As for those men, let them have their jollification. Let them play outside or here in the house. They are merry enough, and why not? Their own stores and cellars are full of bread and drink. Nobody touches it but the servants, while their masters haunt our house every day, killing oxen and fat sheep and goats, feasting and drinking our fine wine recklessly. And so it all goes. For there is no man like Odysseus at the head to drive this curse from the house. If only Odysseus would come back to his own country, he and his son would soon punish the men." As she uttered these words, Telemachus gave a loud sneeze, which made the room ring again. Penelopeia laughed aloud and cried out point blank, "Go, go, call this stranger, bring him to me. Don't you see how my son gave a loud sneeze right upon my words? That means that death will come upon all the intruders. Yes, all, not one shall escape. And mark this, if I find that the man is telling the truth, I will fit him out with fine clothes to wear." The swineherd went off as he was told, and cried out point blank to Odysseus,
"Gaffer,
The mistress wants her, the young master's mother. Thou knows she has a mind to hear about the master, poor dear. And if she finds the telling the truth, thou'lt get a fine rig out in high time, too, and the freedom of the town to go a-begging and fill thy belly for any charitable soul to give what a will.
Odysseus, patient as ever, replied,
"By and by, Eumaeus, I will tell everything honestly to your noble lady, for I know all about him, and we have endured the same hardships. But I fear this mob of dangerous men, whose violence and presumption affront the brazen sky. You saw just now how that man struck me a painful blow when I was only walking about the hall and doing no harm. Telemachus did nothing to stop him, nor did anyone else. Now then tell the lady to wait in her room until sunset, although she is anxious, of course. Then let her ask me about her husband's return while she sits quietly by the fire. I am not properly dressed, as you know yourself, for I appealed first to you.
Eumaeus came back with his message, and as he stepped over the threshold, Penelope said,
"You haven't brought him then, Eumaeus. What has the man in his head? Is he afraid of ill treatment, or just shy of being seen in the house?
Shy beggar is bad beggar."
Eumaeus answered,
"He talks good sense, just what anyone else would think if he wants to keep clear of rowdy men and their heavy hands. He says wait till sunset. Thou'll find it better for thy own sake, my lady, to be alone when you have your talk."
Penelope said, "The stranger is no fool. He guesses what may well happen. I don't think there are any other men alive who go on in this wild, reckless way." The honest swineherd had no more to say, so he returned to the dining hall. There he sought out Telemachus and told him straight in a whisper, putting his head close that the others might not hear,
"My honey, I'm going now to look after my pigs and all that, thy livin' and my livin'. Thy business is here. Take care of thyself first, and don't a run into trouble. Many of the people bear thee ill will, and may God bless them before they do any harm."
Telemachus answered, "That will be all right, Daddy, but have supper before you go, and tomorrow drive down your pigs. I will manage the rest with heaven's help." The swineherd sat down again and had a hearty meal. Then he left the house and went after his swine. Book 18. How Odysseus Fought the Sturdy Beggar. It was afternoon by this time, and the crowd of feasters in the hall were making merry with song and dance when a new visitor appeared. This was the town beggar, who used to go begging about the streets and was well known for his ravenous belly. He was always eating and drinking, but he had neither strength nor guts, although he was a great hulking creature. Aeneas was the name which his mother bestowed on him in the cradle, but all the world called him Iros, because he would run errands for anyone who wanted him. This man tried to drive Odysseus out of the house, and flew at him straight with a rude speech.
"Get away from the door, Greybeard, unless you want to be dragged out by the leg. Don't you see how they are all squinting at me and telling me to drag you out? I'm wholly ashamed to do it. Up with you, before it comes to fisticuffs."
Odysseus said with a frown, "My good man, I do you no harm, and I say no harm. Get as much as you like, I don't grudge it to you. There is room here for both, and you need not grudge another man's goods. You seem to be a vagrom man like me. Wealth is the god's gift, of course. Don't say too much about fists, or you may make me angry. I'm an old man, but I might color your face and chest with ruby red. That would save me trouble tomorrow, for I don't think you would put in a second appearance at the hall of Odysseus Laertiades."
Iros flew into a rage and said,
"Damn it all, how that dirty hog's tongue doth run like an old kitchen wife. I should like to give him a good right and left and knock out all the teeth from his jaws, as if he were a sow in the growing corn. Tuck it up now and let them all see us fight. How could you stand up against a young man?"
While they were prickling and spiking with all their hearts, on the doorstone by the great door his high and mightiness Antinous heard them. Laughing pleasantly, he called out,
My friends, here is a real new sport brought by God to our very doors for our amusement. The stranger and Iros are spoiling for a fight. Let us match them together at once. All the others jumped up, laughing, and made a ring about the ragged pair. Then Antinous said with his father's soft, persuasive tongue, "Look here, my stout fellows, listen to me. Here are a lot of black puddings by the fire, stuffed with blood and fat, ready for supper. Whichever of these two proves the better man, let him come along and choose the one he likes. He shall always have the right to share a meal with us, and no one else shall be allowed to come in here and beg." They thought this a capital notion. But Odysseus was never unready. He, too, had his little plan. And he said, "My friends, an old man, worn out with hardship, cannot stand up against a younger man. Only that damned belly drives me on to take a good beating. But now you must all swear to me solemnly that no one shall give me a foul blow to favor Iros and make me lose the battle." They all swore solemnly to see fair play. This duly done, Telemachus said with great dignity, "Stranger, if you are determined to stand up bravely and fight this man, you need fear no one else. If anyone strikes you, he will find amenities too many for one. I am the host here, and I have the support of two princes, Antinous and Eurymachus, proper men both." This was approved by all. Then Odysseus tucked up his rags about his middle and showed a fine pair of sturdy thighs, broad shoulders and chest and strong arms, for Athena was near him, and she filled out his limbs. The young swaggerers were mightily amazed, and one would say to another, "Our hanger-on will hang off before long, to judge by the muscles of that thigh under the old man's rags." Well, he asked for it. But Iros was in a dreadful state. The servants had to tuck up his clothes for him and drag him into the ring willy-nilly, in such terror that the flesh trembled on his bones. Antinous did not spare him. "You had better never have been born or thought, if you tremble like this and shake with fear, a great lout like you, at an old man worn out by hardships. I'll tell you one thing, and I'll do it too. If he proves the better man, I'll bundle you on board ship across to catch him the bogey king, who chops men up into mincemeat. He shall cut off your nose and ears and cods and throw them to the dogs to eat raw." This made him tremble more than ever. But he was dragged into the ring, and the two men put up their hands. Odysseus considered whether he should hit hard enough to kill on the spot, or give him a gentle tap and down him. On the whole, he thought the gentle tap would be better, or he might be found out. So when they put up their hands, Iros let drive at the right shoulder, but Odysseus struck the man's neck under the ear and broke his jawbone. The red blood gushed out of his mouth, and he fell in the dust, bleating, and gnashed his teeth, drumming with his heels on the ground. The spectators lifted up their hands and fairly died of laughing. Odysseus dragged the man out by one leg through the forehall and into the courtyard near the gate. There he propped him up against the courtyard wall and put his stick in his hand and said loudly, "Sit there now and keep off the pigs and dogs. Don't set up to be a monarch of all the beggars, you miserable wretch, or a worse thing may come upon you." Then he threw his own ragged old rotten bag over the man's shoulders and slung it there by the cord, and back he went to the threshold and sat down. The others went into the hall roaring with laughter and congratulated the winner. "May Zeus and all gods give you the dearest wish of your heart. Now this insatiable beggar will walk in our streets no more. We'll soon bundle him off to catch him the bogey king, who chops up men into mincemeat." Odysseus was glad of the omen when he heard these words. Then Antinous himself set down a huge black pudding by his side, stuffed with fat and blood. Amphinomus took a couple of loaves from the basket and brought them, too, and then pledged him in a golden cup with pleasant words. "Here's good luck, gaffer stranger. Happy days to come. You seem to be unhappy enough now." Odysseus replied, "Amphinomus, you seem to me a man of good understanding, as your father was before you, for I have heard the good repute of Dulichian Nisus as an excellent man and a rich one.
Such was your father, and you seem to be courteous in your ways. Then let me say something you will do well to remember. Of all creatures that breathe and move upon the earth, nothing is bred that is weaker than man. He thinks no evil thing can ever come upon him, so long as the gods give him power and his knees are nimble. But when the blessed gods bring sorrow, he has to bear this also, unwillingly, yet with patient heart. So the spirit of man upon this earth is as the day which the Father of gods and men brings upon him. I myself was once like to be happy amongst men, but I gave way to violent passions and did reckless deeds, trusting to the support of brothers and father. Therefore no man should ever disregard justice, but let him enjoy in silence the gifts which the gods may give him. This is in my mind when I see these pretenders to marriage acting so recklessly, wasting the substance and insulting the wife of a man who, I say, will not long be absent from his friends and his native land. Indeed, he is very near. But I pray that Providence may take you safely to your home and not let you meet him when he comes back to his native land. For I think the pretenders and he will not part without bloodshed when he returns to this house. So saying, he spilled the sacred drops from the cup and drank, and returned the cup into the prince's hands. But Amphinomus moved away, much disturbed in heart and drooping his head, for he had a foreboding of evil. Still in all, he did not escape death. Athena shackled him also to fall in fight by the hands and spear of Telemachus. Now Athena put a new plan into the mind of Penelopeia, to show herself to the pretenders that she might flutter their hearts, and be more valued by husband and son than ever before. She forced a laugh and said to the housewife, "Your enemy, I never had such a wish before, but I have a notion to show myself to those men, much as I hate them, and I should like to warn Telemachus that he had better not go among that rough company. They speak pleasantly, but bad schemes are coming after." Eurynome replied, "That's right, my love. Go and speak a plain word to your boy. Let him have it. But first have a bath and give your cheeks a rub down with oil. Don't go out with that tear-bedabbled face. Eternal lacrimation is a sorry occupation. Remember how your son is grown up now, and how your greatest prayer always was to see him a bearded man." Penelopeia said, "Don't coax me, your enemy, though I know it is only your kind heart. I will not bathe or smooth down my face with oil, for all my comeliness is gone. The gods who rule Olympus destroyed it on the day when my man left and sailed away. But tell Antinoe and Hippodamia to come, that they may attend me in the hall. I will not go among men alone. No modest woman would do that." So the old woman went to call the maids. Then Athena did her part. She made Penelopeia lie down on her bed and fall into a deep sleep, with every limb and muscle at rest. And as she lay there, the goddess instilled her divine gifts, that she might win the admiration of all beholders. First she cleansed the fair face with immortal balm of beauty, such as Cythera uses when she goes all garlanded to the Graces' lovely dance. Then she made her tall and full, and more white than polished ivory. And when her work was done, the waiting women came chattering out of their room. The lady woke up and rubbed her cheeks, saying, "Oh, that was a soft slumber that made me forget my troubles. Oh, that holy Artemis would grant me at this moment a death soft like that, so that I might no longer waste my days in mourning, no longer miss my dear husband and his incomparable goodness, for there never was a man like him." Now she came down from her room with two maids in waiting. When she reached the company, she stood by the doorpost of the great hall, holding the veil shimmering before her cheeks, and one maid stood on each side. The men were thrilled, and their hearts warmed with love, and each man prayed that she might hereafter lie by his side. Then she spoke to her son and said quietly, "Telemachus, Your spirit is not what it used to be. What a boy you were, as clever as could be, and determined. Now you are grown up and come of age, and one who didn't know you might think, to look at you, that you belong to a great family, for you are a fine big fellow. But your spirit is not what it was, and you don't know what is right. See what has been done in this hall, when you let a stranger be maltreated like this. How would it be if the stranger comes to harm by being mishandled in this cruel way while he sits here in our hall? It would be a shame and a disgrace to you in the world.
Telemachus answered with his usual good sense, Mother dear, I can't be surprised that you are angry. I do notice everything, and I know quite well what is good and what is bad. I was only a child before. But I cannot think always of the right thing to do, for these men fairly daze me. Here they sit on this side and on that side, full of malice, and I have no one to help me. However, that mill between Iros and the stranger did not come off as these men wished. The stranger was the better man. Oh, Father Zeus, Athena, Apollo, may these bullies in our house bow their heads in defeat. May they be broken and lie in the courtyard or here in the hall, as surely as Iros lies now beside the gateway with his head lolling like a drunken man and can't stand up or go home on his feet because he is wholly broken up. As they were talking together, Eurymachus called out to Penelopeia, My lady Penelopeia, if all our nation could see you from north to south, there would be a crowd of newcomers dining here tomorrow and aspiring to your hand, for you are the pearl of women for beauty and intelligence too. Penelopeia replied, Eurymachus, all my comeliness and beauty, as you call it, the immortal gods took from me. When the army embarked for the war, and with them went my husband, Odysseus. If that man would come and care for me, I should have a greater and better name in the world. But now I can only mourn for the afflictions which heaven has sent. What he said to me when he left his native land was this. He clasped my right hand by the wrist and said, My wife, I do not think all our brave men will come back from Troy safely. They say the Trojans are warriors as we are, lancers and archers and men who can use a horse, such men as can most quickly turn the day in a hard-fought field. So I do not know if God will spare me, or if I shall fall in the Trojan land. I leave you the care of all that is here. Care for my father and mother in this place, as you do now, or even more when I am far away. And when you see our son with a beard on his face, leave your house and marry the man of your choice. And now all is happening as he said. A night will come when that hateful marriage will fall to my lot, and mine is a wretched lot since Zeus took my happiness away. But I have a bitter humiliation to bear. Your way of wooing a wife was never seen before. Those who would win a woman of rank and wealth vie with one another in offering herds of cattle and flocks of sheep, and feasting the lady's friends, and heaping gifts upon her. They do not devour the wealth of another without compensation. Odysseus had some comfort now for his patient heart, to see how she attracted their gifts while she wheedled them with soft words, and had quite other thoughts in her mind. Antinous saw there was reason in that, as his father's son ought to do, and he answered, What you say is true, my lady Penelopeia, and we should not forget whose daughter you are. Let each bring what he thinks proper, and do you accept our gifts, for it is not fair to refuse a gift. But we will not go back to our lands or anywhere else until you marry one of us. The others were all content, and each sent a man to bring their gifts. Antinous provided a magnificent robe, richly embroidered. It had golden buckles, a round dozen of them fitted with curved clasps. Eurymachus gave a gold chain of fine workmanship, studded with amber beads and sparkling like the sun. Eurydamas had a pair of earrings, each with a cluster of three drops, and a groom to carry each earring, a lovely pair of trinkets. From the house of Pisandros Polyctorides came a servant with a beautiful necklace. So each of them offered his own fine gift. Then Penelopeia returned to her chamber, and the women carried away the gifts. The young men now amused themselves with singing and dancing to while away the time until evening, and soon the darkness came on. Then they placed three braziers in the hall to give light, and piled round them heaps of good dry sticks, neatly chopped up for the purpose. In between were torches, and relays of maids looked after the light. By and by, Odysseus said to the maids,
"My good girls, it's long since you saw your master. But now you may go to your quarters and your gracious mistress. Sit in her room and make yourselves pleasant. Spin the yarn, card the wool, and I will show a light for all these gentlemen. If they like to carry on till daylight doth appear, they will not beat me. I am a patient man."
The girls laughed and glanced at one another. But one had a sharp tongue, that cherry-cheeked wench Melantho, Dolius' daughter. She was a favorite with Penelopeia, who treated her like her own child and gave her trinkets to please her fancy. But she was ungrateful and cared nothing for her mistress. Indeed, she was the sweetheart of Eurymachus. This young minx rated Odysseus roundly.
"Well, Mr. Patience, your wits must have been smacked out of you. Why don't you go and sleep at the smithy, or the gossip's hostel, instead of giving play to your tongue here before all these gentlemen, bold as brass? I wonder you aren't ashamed. The wine has gone to your head, or perhaps you are always like that with your bibble-babble. Are you above yourself because you beat Iros, the beggar? Take care, someone better than Iros doesn't turn up to box your ears well for you and kick you out of the house in a pretty mess."
Odysseus frowned at her and said,
"Just wait a minute, you bitch, and I will see what Telemachus has to say. When he hears what you have said, he'll soon chop you up into mincemeat."
This sent them scurrying away, and they fled to their rooms terrified to death, for they all thought he meant it. But he took his post near the braziers to keep up the light, and watched all the company. His mind was full of other thoughts, which came to pass in due time. But Athena would not suffer the young bullies to cease from their humiliating insults, for she wished to excite the anger of Odysseus still more. So Eurymachus began to make game of him, and raised the laugh by saying, "Look here, my good rivals for the great lady's hand, I have just had a happy thought. Shall I tell you what it is? Some kind divinity has sent this man here. At least, I think there's a brilliant illumination coming from the top of his head, the torchlight, perhaps, for there's not one hair upon it." And then he called out to Odysseus, "Do you want a job, stranger? What if I take you on? My place is in the country. I'd give you good wages, laying walls and planting trees. You should have your keep all the year round, clothes to wear and boots to tread on. But you have never learned anything but vice. You won't do honest work, only tramp the country to fill your greedy belly." Odysseus made quite a speech in answer to this.
"Eurymachus," he said, "I should be glad if you and I could have a match in the springtime when the long days come round. In the hayfield, say, let us have a try. Give me a well-curved scythe, and you take another. Plenty of grass, nothing to eat or drink till it is quite dark. Or what about ploughing? The best oxen to be had, a couple of big tawny beasts, the same age and strength, never tired. Give them a good feed, and put us on a 4-acre field, and let the plough turn up the sods. Then you should see if I could run a straight furrow to the end. Or if Cronion should stir up war from some quarter this very day, let me have a shield, and a couple of spears, and a metal cap to fit over my temples. You should see me fighting in the first rank, and you would have nothing to say about greedy bellies. You are only a bully, and your temper is ungentle. You think yourself great and strong because you mix with a small society of nobodies. But if Odysseus should come back to his native land, those wide portals would give you no room to run out of the door."
At this, Eurymachus was infuriated and scowled at him as he blurted out,
"Base clown, I'll punish you for talking like that before all this company, bold as brass. I wonder you are not ashamed. The wine has gone to your head, no doubt, or are you always like that with your bibble-babble?" Then he caught up a footstool to throw,
But Odysseus ducked behind the knees of Amphinomus, and the stool hit the man with the wine on the right arm. Down went the jug with a bang, and the man fell on his back on the dust, yelling. Then there was a great uproar, and cries and exclamations on all sides.
"I wish the stranger had gone tramping to the devil before ever he came here. Then we should have been spared this noise. Now we are brawling over a beggar, and there's no pleasure in a good meal, for this is no place for a decent man."
Telemachus now called them to order with dignity. "Gentlemen, what is this? You are behaving like madmen, and you cannot carry your food and drink quietly. Some malign spirit must be driving you on. You have had a good dinner. Now, go home and rest when you find it convenient. I chase no man away." They bit their lips and heard with surprise how confidently he spoke. Then Amphinomus said,
"My good friends, that is quite fair, and no one has any right to object or to feel annoyed. Don't maltreat the stranger or anyone else. Come along now, let the man pour the drops in our cups, that we may do the act of grace and go home to rest. Leave the stranger for Telemachus to look after, according to his duty as host."
They were all well satisfied to do as he said. The mixing bowl was filled by that majestic herald, Mulius of Dulichion, who was a servitor of Amphinomus. He went the round, stopping by each guest to pour in his drops. They spilled the libation in turn, and drank what they wanted, and went away for the night's rest, each man to his own lodging. Book 19. How the Old Nurse Knew Her Master. So Odysseus was left in the hall, brooding over his vengeance, with Athena in his thoughts. He spoke at once to Telemachus and gave him clear directions. "All the arms must be put in the storeroom," he said. "If anyone misses them and asks questions, answer as civilly as you can. I have put them away out of the smoke. You can see now they are not what they were when Odysseus went to Troy. They are quite spoilt by the fumes from the fire. Yes, and there is another thing I have just thought of. Suppose the wine should go into your heads. You may quarrel together and disgrace your dinner and your wooing both. You know the saying, bare steel in sight draws men to fight." Telemachus listened, and calling his nurse Eurycleia, he said to her, "Nanny, shut up the women in their rooms. I am going to put away father's fine armory. All the things are hanging about neglected since he went away, and the smoke is spoiling them. I am not a child now, you know. I want to put them away where the fumes from the fire will not reach them." The old nurse answered,
"Ay, my love, I only wish thou'd brush up thy wits to take charge of the house and all that's in it. Come now, who shall go fetch a light for thee? The maids might have done it, but they mustn't move out of their rooms."
The boy said, "This strange man will do. No one shall be idle who touches my ration basket if he has come from a long way off." The nurse did not understand the secret of what he said, but she locked the doors of the women's rooms. Then Odysseus and his son sprang up and carried away helmets and bossy shields and sharp spears. Pallas Athena went before them with a golden lamp and made a brilliant light. Telemachus said,
"Oh, father! Here is a wonderful thing which I see with my own eyes. Really and truly, I can see the walls of the rooms, and the fine panels, and the pine wood rafters and lofty pillars, all clear to my eyes as if a fire were blazing. Surely one of the gods who rule the broad heavens is in this place."
Odysseus answered, "Be silent, check your fancies, and ask no questions. This is the way of the gods who rule Olympus. Now, go and lie down. Leave me alone here, for I want to tease the maids and your mother a little more, and she will ask me everything amid showers of tears." So Telemachus went along under the torchlight to lie down in his own room, where he always used to rest. There he remained until dawn. But Odysseus was left in the hall, brooding over his vengeance and thinking of Athena's promise.
Now Penelopea came from her chamber, beautiful as Artemis or golden Aphrodite. A fine couch was put ready for her, a work of Icmalius, the master craftsman, inlaid with spirals of ivory and silver. It had a footrest attached, and a thick fleece was laid upon it. There sat Penelopeia, while the maids came in and cleared away bread and tables and cups. They emptied the braziers on the floor and filled them again with wood for light and warmth. Then Melantho rated Odysseus once more.
"Still here, you stranger? Going to make yourself a nuisance all night, rolling about the house and ogling the women? Get out of this, you creature, and be thankful for your dinner, or a firebrand shall help you on your way."
Odysseus frowned and said,
"My good woman, why do you attack me with such bitterness? Because I am dirty and ragged and go begging about the town? I can't help that. Beggars and vagrants are all like that. I had once a house of my very own in the world. I was happy and rich and often gave to a homeless man, whoever he might be, and whatever he wanted.